From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Millions of Americans have been in a state of shock, grief, depression since the 2024 election. MSNBC's viewership has dropped off in huge numbers as a disappointed constituency has stopped watching the news. Are you one of those? I am. I haven't even wanted to watch Colbert or Seth Meyers, let alone The Daily Show, and forget Face the Nation and Meet the Press. You know, what happened? Well, From the Bookshelf has turned to our panel of expert, William Cooper. He's the author of How America Works and Why It Doesn't, A Brief Guide to the U.S. Political System, to help us figure it all out. William Cooper, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be here.
You know, we know that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. I mean, even you, with your fair-minded and even-handed, annoying bipartisanship, you characterize Trump as not good. So how screwed are we?
Well, it's the right question to ask. And yes, I you know, try to be as rational as I can. And using the most rationality I can muster in assessing things, I still come to the conclusion that Donald Trump is a huge problem, even though a lot of huge problems that other people think, a lot of things other people think are huge problems, I might not. He certainly qualifies. I think we are quite screwed in a lot of ways. I think, and we could talk some about it today, more screwed in some ways than we appreciate and less screwed in others than we appreciate. And
let's start with the good news then. Tell us some areas in which we are less in danger than we fear.
I think that the domestic system that we have of checks and balances and federalism, a strong, very different now, but nonetheless, I think strong in some ways, media ecosystem. I think those checks, balances, protections, I think they work really well in a lot of areas and in a lot of ways. I think the idea, for example, that Trump is going to become a dictator is really inaccurate and baseless. I mean, he can't even get his attorney general nominee, you know, a hearing in the Senate. He's not going to take over the whole of the government. So I think that he's going to do harm. And as a Republican, Republican policies and judges, things of that nature are going to go forward. But the idea here at home, it's going to cross some threshold into true dictatorship or authoritarianism, I think is wrong.
Okay, but he does have the Supreme Court because he has stacked the court with his people who have said such things as, you know, he's immune from prosecution for anything he's ever done. So there's that issue. What about the court?
Well, I definitely do not think he has five Supreme Court justices that will rubber stamp initiatives that get us anywhere near dictatorship. I think that's a conservative court, and there will be lots of conservative decisions, some of which help Trump. But the idea that they would bless things that move the country into dictatorship or anything close to that, I think is very wrong. I don't see any indication or opinions of the court suggesting anything close to that. It doesn't mean they won't do harm. It doesn't mean we're not screwed. It just means the idea that Trump's going to become a dictator, which so many people have said,
yeah,
I think it is really misguided.
Even he said it. Let's remember.
Absolutely. And his batting average for saying things that happen is very low.
That's true. Well, in terms of the cabinet picks that you mentioned, alluded to there, like Matt Gaetz, I remember reading a book about the Smothers Brothers, and they had their famous television show in the 1960s, and they were constantly harangued by the censors. And so they would come up with jokes that they knew would not get through and that there would be a huge, you know, uproar over, so that they could slip in jokes that people were not, would not notice, right? So, you know, Matt Gaetz might be one of those. Let's put up the worst possible person so that everybody focuses on that while he slips through a lot of really terrible people in other cabinet posts.
That's a very smart insight and analogy, Gary. I like that a lot, and I hadn't thought about it. That may be a part of it, certainly consistent with that. If you were going to come up with the worst nominee imaginable, Matt Gaetz would be a strong candidate,
yeah.
And he did that. I'm very interested to see what happens with Tulsi Gabbard, this defense secretary, you know, guy who's you know, unbelievably unfit for office, and others. I'm very, you know, we saw what happened with Gaetz. I'm very interested to see what happens with others. I think it's, you know, one of the, I said in the beginning, I think in some ways people are overstating the threat of Trump. And I've given some examples here. I think they're also in some ways not focusing enough on the true threat of Trump, which I think is in the international realm more than anywhere else. And the fact that he's got these clowns being put up for wildly important positions is an indicator of how big that threat is. So you make a great point, and I am very concerned about these cabinet nominees.
So far, I'm not feeling that much better. But William Cooper, were you surprised at the outcome of the election?
I've been very surprised and very wrong repeatedly about Trump's ability to sustain his dominance over the Republican Party and his, you know, capturing so many hearts and minds in this country for so long. But by the time we were casting votes, I had come to see just how influential he was. And the polling suggested that it was very close. And I thought it was going to be a toss-up and that he'd win. And that one of them would, you know, it was roughly 50-50 at that point. So I wasn't shocked that he won. I thought it was a toss-up. I was surprised, but not shocked, frankly, but surprised at how decisive his victory was in getting the the popular vote.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the case like with Hillary Clinton, where I was confident on election night he was going to lose, and then he won.
Well, of course, now we know from the analysis of the election that more people voted for someone other than Trump than voted for Trump. And I look at the fact that he's run for president 3 times, and he won against a woman, and then he lost against a man, and then won against a woman. So what role do you think gender played in the ultimately in this election?
I have a very unscientific view of that, but I feel like what I'm about to say is true without any data supporting it. But I think there's something about gender that is important, and that there is what you've touched on is important in the outcomes of these elections. I thought it with Hillary. I think it, you know, with Kamala. It's consistent with it, but it doesn't mean that causation's as I think. But my sense is there are lots of people in this country. Again, we have 350 million people, and our elections come down to thousands of people in some county in Wisconsin.
Right.
So even if you have 1% of Americans thinking something, that's 3 million people and many, many voters. But I do think that in this country, more so in red states than in blue states, the prejudice against women as being in a leadership role is actually more dramatic than racial prejudice, and that some of that comes from what people see in their homes as they're raised, and just how they've interacted with and thought about women there throughout their lives. And I think it's a real factor.
Well, I noticed in that little thing that you just said that you referred to Kamala and Hillary rather than Clinton and Harris, but we always say Trump. Is there part of the sexism in America related to that? I mean, repeatedly you heard this on television and as well as just right now. People do not refer to her as Harris or Vice President Harris, but rather Kamala.
It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, Harris is Clinton. You can't say Clinton because you don't know if you mean Bill or Hillary. And then Harris is a pretty common name. Everybody knows who Trump is just by the usage. And maybe there's something there at the beginning. And then once you hear Kamala referred to as Kamala 99 out of 100 times, that's what you say. I don't know. But I think you're focused on a very interesting and important place, which is gender. And I'm very hungry to see a really in-depth study of that and somebody smart really looking into it and seeing if my hunch is right or not. Have you seen anything there or have any thoughts?
I've been
on
reading
that?
Mostly the funnies.
Yeah. Well, there's wisdom there.
No, I really have been turned off to the news. I don't want to hear it. I didn't like the criticism of President Biden having pardoned his son. But I'd like to know your thoughts on that. Did you think that was a bad thing or a good thing or what?
I think there's way bigger things to worry about than that. I think the pardon debate, some of this may be because I've been inflicted upon myself a legal education and a career as a lawyer. But the pardon debate to me it's very often really misguided and ignorant to me. And I think that the obsession with pardons is often, a really big mistake. And giving leniency to somebody in the criminal justice system is usually not something to be up in arms about. That's my general view. There are exceptions, but the debate tends to feel very unintelligible to me. For example, and this is just an example of something that I saw a lot of that just made no sense to me. A lot of the people that supported Biden's decision to pardon his son said, well, Trump's threatening to prosecute him, so he's justified in pardoning him. And I don't disagree with the impulse there, but you could certainly have crafted a pardon that only applied prospectively, and Joe's pardon didn't do that. So it just, the debate is often, off track to me. That's a really long-winded way of I should have just stuck with my first five words or whatever of saying I didn't think it was that big of a deal.
Well, okay, so here's my idea. What about this? It's not going to happen because my wife said it's not a TV show, it's real life. But here's what I would, if I were writing this scenario, I would have, today, I would have President Biden resign for health reasons so that Kamala Harris becomes president. And then she could have appoint someone as her vice president, like, say, Walz. And then she could issue sweeping pardons for Liz Cheney and Hillary Clinton and all the other people that Trump has said are his enemies that he plans to jail. And then her vice president could say that even the candidate, Trump, said up until the moment that he won the election that there was irregularities in the election, and therefore he refuses to certify the votes and until we sort out whether or not there were irregularities and his legal proceedings have to be sorted out, and that we said that he was a threat to democracy, therefore we're not going to allow that threat to go forward.
I let me chew on that for a sec. I mean, I think
it would be a good season finale, that's for sure.
It would be a wonderful, wonderfully entertaining saga. I think we're as horrible as the outcome of the election was, I think given the options that are before us, what Biden and Harris and the current administration is doing is going forward with the peaceful transfer of power is probably the right approach. In terms of issuing pardons to protect Liz Cheney, people that Trump has said he's gone after, I think that's a great idea. I strongly support that.
He'll do it now that he knows you support it.
If those pardons are necessary, then they've prevented great harm. And if they're not necessary, they've done no harm. So just do it.
I agree. All right. I'm going to put a call into Biden and tell him that I've got your back on this. Well, I mean, there is a certain frustration. I'm joking, of course, but there's a certain frustration in not having enough say in what goes on. I mean, when you look at the fact that millions of Americans voted for somebody else, that the 50% of senators, or now it's more than 50% of Republican senators, represent a much smaller number of Americans than the Democrats. Those are frustrations I know we've talked about before and that are addressed in your book, but talk about them a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real frustration and tension in our polity. I mean, our country was set up constitutionally under very different circumstances when we were very small. And, you know, we were the equivalent of like, you know, a mid-sized town today. And how would you govern, you know, a small little area with not that many people? It's very different when this juggernaut of a country we have now with 350 million people. One of the only positive things, and the negatives far outweighed the positives, but one of the only positive things about the election was that it wasn't close. And so, you know, the tension of the Electoral College going one way, the popular vote going the other way, and so on, wasn't there. And also, if there had been a really close election, the fight would have been really horrible. It probably would have gone to the Supreme Court, and it would have created many, many. I still think the country is reeling from Bush versus Gore in some significant ways. I can only imagine how ugly it would have gotten and lasting. The Senate representation is a great point, and that's true. In a variety of contexts, does it make any sense for one senator to have all the same power of another when they're representing 2% of the population? I'm always in favor of the one person, one vote. Each vote has equal power, and the more we can move towards that, the better. So we're quite far away in that respect.
Well, you do talk in your book, William Cooper, How America Works and Why It Doesn't, A Brief Guide to the U.S. Political System, about the Electoral College and the difficulty involved in doing away with it. Are we any closer to being able to do away with it now?
No. we're very far away. It's in the Constitution, and that doesn't change until it's amended, and it's expressed. There's ambiguities in the Constitution or things that aren't there that the Supreme Court can put in there. But when you have something expressed like that, you're stuck with it. The president, you're not going to be able to be president until you're 35 years old. You're not going to get rid of the Electoral College. Those things just aren't going to change. And the idea that the American polity that can barely put one foot in front of the other, frankly, we aren't even putting one foot in front of the other right now, can coalesce around a constitutional amendment like that just seems wildly unlikely.
So one of the fears about Trump, even though he is, I think he just turned 200 years old, is the fact that he could try to run again. And of course, there was a president not that long ago who ran four times and won four times. What has changed since FDR that would prevent Trump from running for a third term?
Well, the term limits, you know, we now have term limits. I think it's a real concern, just given who Trump is and what he's shown he's capable of. And it's an interesting thought experiment. I mean, we learned last time that there are limits to what people will do in support of Trump. His most slavish deputy was Mike Pence. Couldn't have been more supportive of Trump the entire time he was president, but he drew a line when it came to certifying the vote before Congress and reversing the election, thankfully. I hope we don't have to find where the outer thresholds are again of this, but we may, and it's a real concern. We cannot rule out that he tries to run again and tries to get his party behind that. I think it would probably create significant litigation immediately at the state level. The states handle presidential elections. I think it would go to the Supreme Court, and I do think the Supreme Court, even as it's currently constituted, would not rule in favor of Trump. But then you'd run into peaceful transfer of power and all of that. So that's a really, I very much don't want to learn how that story unfolds.
I mean, would he have any grounds in saying that, you know, because he is now a different president than he was in the first, because he was 45 and now he's 47. So 47 is allowed two terms, and therefore it wouldn't violate any of the rules to have him run again.
I read a piece briefly a few weeks ago that said, and I didn't look at the language, but the piece, I can't remember what publication, but a reputable publication specifically addressed that and said that the constitutional provision on term limits does in fact apply, even if it's not sequential. But I haven't done my own study of it, but I think that's the case. That you're limited to.
But the term limits is a constitutional, not an amendment, but it's a rule, but not an amendment. Is that right? I mean, after Truman, I guess, right? They said they didn't want to have that ever happen again, that somebody would rule for 12 years. And so they put in a provision or what?
I believe it was an amendment. You can't change the Constitution without going through the amendment process. I need to study this. Hopefully not as it's unfolding, but just out of curiosity. But my understanding is there's a full-blown constitutional amendment. I know for sure you can't change the Constitution absent that process. And I also think that it does not only limit consecutive terms, but applies generally. And I am actually in an era of not knowing how many things would unfold. I actually have a lot of confidence the Supreme Court would not rule in Trump's favor if he tried to do that. And I think states would just refuse to put him on the ballot and they'd be allowed to do that. But he would still make a mess of it, right? And then you have to transfer power after an election and all of that. So,
well, I still have some big questions. During the campaign, when there was a televised debate in which one candidate was articulate and prepared and the other candidate said, I have a concept of a plan, and that people are eating their pets, do we know, are debates no longer meaningful?
I don't know what is meaningful anymore, Gary. I mean, Trump, I mean, he said people are eating their pets, and then he won.
Yeah.
We are at a place in our nation's history where just discourse and logic just don't mean what they used to. And I don't understand it.
All right. Well, let's talk about what lies ahead then. We talked briefly about the cabinet picks, but you said that there was some concern about our foreign affairs in the future. What about Ukraine? What about his relationship with Putin? What about Israel? What about all that?
Yeah, so I think, as I said earlier, I think in some places Americans are really afraid of things in ways they shouldn't be, but in other ways aren't giving it enough attention to places they should be. Foreign affairs historically is a place where I think Americans don't focus as much as they should. I think that's true in general. I think most human beings are parochial. Most countries, the people there look kind of myopically at their own circumstances. So I don't think it's unique to us that this is the case. But with Trump, there are, and we saw this his first presidency, there really are enormous number of barriers for him to accomplish the things that are sort of worst case scenarios. The Supreme Court that you mentioned, the Supreme Court ruled against Trump over and over and over again over the last 10 years. I mean, they rejected his 2020 presidential election litigation. They ruled against him on DACA. They ruled against him on LGBTQ rights. They let the January 6th committee get his records and so on and so on and so on. And, you know, there's I think, a three-person majority in the House. So if the Democrats can get three people from the Republican side out of 220, they can stymie, you know, his legislative agenda in various instances. But in foreign affairs, he can just pick up the phone and call Putin whenever he wants. He can just tweet some insult to Chairman Xi before breakfast. And those actions and just his representation of America on the world stage are extremely consequential. They can be decisive factors in international flashpoints. And he is our head of state. And so to me, that is more concerning than whatever legislation a razor-thin Republican majority can muster in the House.
One of the reasons that we are so supportive of Ukraine is because Putin were to just simply win in that conflict, it could lead to a larger European war involving NATO, which would involve us, and we would end up going to war. What is the likelihood of that occurring?
That's a really good question. I confess to not being a real expert in this space. It's really complicated, and I'm not an expert, but I do think that is a very legitimate concern, and the leading people in this space, who I respect a lot, have that very concern. We will see. The status quo, that is a very incredibly important concern and valid one. I also think the status quo in Ukraine is absolutely horrible. I mean, the price that we're paying right now, with hundreds of thousands of people dying and an entire generation of young people in a country being eviscerated, that's as staggering and tragic a toll as you could pay for them. It's an incredible price to be paying. And so while I don't have a nuanced, you know, really educated view on exactly what we should do, I just, you know, desperately hope there can be a status quo that's better than what we have today, that doesn't lead to emboldening Russia.
What about this tariff thing? President Trump claims that tariffs will pay for every one of his plans, proposals, and that tariffs will lower the prices on American goods and be good for American jobs.
It's illiterate. It makes no sense. If Trump's economic agenda were to be fully implemented, it would cause inflation to skyrocket. And what we did, tariffs and otherwise, deporting a bunch of people, I mean, these are just inflation juicing policies. If that were to happen, as we learned recently, the American electorate, like most electorates, really don't like paying more money for things. Inflation is a huge political factor, not just a cold economic one. So if he does implement all these policies, I think inflation goes up a lot, and then that could be a significant detriment to the MAGA movement. So in some ways, I like it. I think of the people that did vote for Trump, many of them, not a majority, but many of them didn't like the incumbent or didn't like paying more for their groceries or didn't think the economy was doing well. That was a big part of it. And if he goes forward with this agenda, he'll generate those same negative feelings towards his own administration. So in that sense, it could have a positive political effect. But I don't think he will. I think it's, again, the ratio of things he says to the things he does is very, very, very small.
Well, we do have his first term to look back on, in which he
correct
didn't accomplish many of his proposals.
I think that's right.
In immigration, deportation, you were just mentioning it. So if he deported large numbers of illegal, or not, what is it, undocumented, let's say, undocumented aliens, then that would lead to an increase in prices in the grocery store. Is that what you're saying?
Labor costs would go up fairly dramatically. It would decrease the labor pool in a significant way. And a lot of that labor market does go straight to the grocery store. So I think it would be quite dramatic.
So it wouldn't increase the job opportunities for native-born Americans?
I think my sense is at the margins it may for some, but the net impact, if again he were to do what he actually is saying he would do, the net impact would be millions and millions of less workers in the work. I mean, unemployment's low. So it's not like half the country sitting around trying to find work, and because somebody was from another country, they don't have it. There's some of that, again, at the margins. The net impact would be a very dramatic reduction in the labor force, which has a very strong relationship with labor costs and inflation. I don't think he's going to do anything remotely close to what he's saying he's going to do in that space for a variety of reasons. One of them is just I don't think he could get it done even if he wanted to. But remember, he promised big deportations and huge clampdowns at the border. Remember, build the wall and Mexico's going to pay for it. That's what he campaigned on the first time. His deportations, his first presidency, were fewer than Obama's.
Well, what about the involvement of Elon Musk in this post-election world? I mean, and of course, he had a big involvement in the pre-election world as well, because he became the owner of Twitter, now called X for some unknown reason. And if you ever pick up your X anymore, the first thing you see is, no matter what you do to block things, you will see Elon Musk tweets about how wonderful Donald Trump is. And he is incredibly wealthy and apparently has a great deal of influence over the president-elect.
Yeah, I saw the other day he contributed $250 million to Trump's campaign. We can thank the Supreme Court and Citizens United for that outcome. I think it's concerning. Once you're elected president, you're allowed to take the advice from where you want to take it. And so even if Musk doesn't have a official government role, I think he can be widely influential. And he doesn't have any, really intelligent sort of practical people are good at recognizing the limits of their knowledge, right? And they'll stay in their lane. Elon Musk obviously knows a lot about technology companies and running them and things of that nature, but there's no limit to the things that weighs in on and wants to get involved in. And so I think it's a real concern. I think he could have a lot of influence over Trump in a lot of different areas.
We are talking with William Cooper, and he is the author of an excellent book. It's called How America Works and Why It Doesn't, A Brief Guide to the U.S. Political System. And in your book, you talk a bit about how you talk a lot about the polarization of America and how we got into these two teams, belief systems. And so do you see this coming to an end anytime soon based on the current election?
Definitely don't see it coming to an end. That's for sure. I do believe, and I have some amount of confidence in this, it's not just a hope, that when Trump leaves the scene, whenever that is, and it shouldn't be, you know, he's 78 years old. I do think there will be a reversion toward the mean in a material way that's helpful and positive. I do not think he's the only problem. I think the country and his supporters have embraced him in a major way, and there's more to it than just him. But I think he is uniquely problematic from the perspective of polarization, and that J.D. Vance or Nikki Haley or Ron DeSantis or whoever steps in, we will still have roiling politics for sure, but it will look a lot more like 2012 than it does today.
I thought that if the Democrats had nominated George Clooney, they would have won, because George Clooney, like Donald Trump, was on television. And I think that's one of the parts of his appeal. And, yeah. And George Clooney has a certain amount of gravitas, and he's a political activist. I think that would have been the perfect choice.
I think that's a great point.
Fighting fire with fire seems to be a thing that Democrats don't do very well.
I agree. I don't think the Democrats... I think there's a lot of room for improvement, and I think George Clooney was an example of that. I think that would have been a real. He probably would have won.
I think so too. And nobody listens to me, except for you people who are listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. And this is William Cooper. Do you think that if Trump follows through on even some of these things, tariffs, deportation, that would lead to a huge midterm victory for the blue states?
I think if he really follows through with it and then I think the answer is yes, because I think if he follows through with it, the inflation will be very dramatic. And everybody knows, and it's still true today. I mean, some things today, some of the old traditions and rules of politics don't apply anymore. Like, for example, scandals used to actually mean something.
That's right.
And now they're just completely disregarded as nothing.
Right. Gary Hart had a girl sitting on his lap on a boat. It was the end of his career.
Yeah, and that would have been number 796 on Trump's list.
Yeah.
But some things still do work, and some rules still are in effect. And one of them, and this isn't changing, is the economy and inflation and how people, you know, when you go to the gas station, most Americans go to the gas station, they pay more for gas than they did the last time. They think of the president, just how people are. So if Trump implements his agenda, I think inflation will go up dramatically. And I think that will crater the political momentum that he currently has. Well, one of the things going for us now that wasn't going for us before is just the incumbency. It's hard to be an incumbent. People get mad and angry at various things. And if you see it in other countries too, I mean, the UK can't seem to have a prime minister for more than a few weeks.
That's right. But of course, you know, if you look, you're talking about the Bush-Gore era earlier. And when George W. Bush was elected president, there was, you know, tremendous amount of grief and, you know, it was a very close election that was then decided by the Supreme Court. But in 2004, after, you know, starting a war pointlessly George W. Bush still won, and he actually won. That wasn't one that was questioned at all. I mean, he won legitimately.
I think there was still a non-trivial strand in the country that was rallying behind Bush in the wake of 9/11. It was a huge, huge wave of support right after 9/11, and the polling was insanely aberrational, where he had like 80% approval ratings, things like that. And it slowly went down. But by the time the 2004 election happened, it was still there to some extent. And it was essentially gone within a year or two from that election. But my sense is that the difference in the Electoral College and somewhat of a close race, not a super tight race, but it wasn't like tens of millions of votes between the two. I think that was a part of it. That's my sense. You can overcome the incumbency. And then I think Obama, to me, was a generational political talent that overcame it. But I do think, as we've seen that with our last two elections, it's tough to be an incumbent. And so.
Yeah. What about J.D. Vance? What do you think J.D. Vance will be president before the end of the next 4-year cycle?
I'm knocking on wood. The sooner the better. I think J.D. Vance is, like I said earlier, I think Trump is unique in really bad ways. I'm not a huge J.D. Vance fan, but I think he would be much more in line with a traditional Republican politician, a traditional Republican president. So,
you think it would be better for the country if Trump were to be in some way unable to complete his term and have J.D. Vance take over?
100%. J.D. Vance would be better than Trump at getting things done, which in some ways would be hard, right? He mm-hmm. would do a better job of navigating legislation through Congress that I wouldn't like.
Yes.
He would do a better job of working the administrative state to execute the laws in ways that are arch conservative. So he would do more harm than Trump in certain ways because he's so much more intelligent than Trump is. But I think in the international realm, he would bring a rationality and sobriety that Trump just doesn't have. And that doesn't mean J.D. Vance is the most rational and sober person out there. I just think Trump is completely off his rocker compared to the typical person that sits behind the desk in the Oval Office. And I think Vance would bring much more stability. I mean, the biggest thing for me with Trump is that we live in this volatile world, and Trump just stirs that pot in a way that's not rooted in understanding. It's not rooted in curiosity. It's not rooted in rationality. And so I think J.D. Vance, like numerous others, would be much better to be our head of state.
So he might do irreparable damage to our country internally, but it would be better for us in the outside, the foreign affairs, because the world would not be destroyed.
We're comparing him to Trump domestically.
Yeah.
So I think Trump's not, Trump's going to get a bunch of judges confirmed and all that. I think J.D. Vance actually understands our constitutional system. Donald Trump has no clue. I mean, Donald Trump has said publicly the Constitution is like a foreign language. This guy is Article 2, and he thinks it's a foreign language. So it's easy. There's a lot of people Vance is benefiting from the comparison here.
Okay. So let's sum up. Where can we find hope?
I think we can find hope in that we should have optimism in a very long-term view. Zoom out and look at the things this country's been through and gotten through. And it's better to be an American right now, sitting in your chair and sitting in my chair, than it was throughout a big chunk of our history for a variety of reasons. And I also think in the long view, taking that long view, it's easier to be optimistic about what happens when Trump does leave. I think he is unique, and I think that he's not going to be replaced by somebody with the particular ingredients to cause harm and polarization that he has. And now, many people were absolutely miserable the entire time George W. Bush was president and thought the world was falling apart. And that'll happen if J.D. Vance is president in 6 years. But the really dramatic, unique challenges we face now, I think, are going to go away when Trump goes away. And we'll be back to a more traditional place where everybody's screaming and yelling, but the range of outcomes is much narrower.
And when you say it's difficult for an incumbent, would that indicate that you think a Democrat will probably be victorious if it weren't a woman in the next presidential election?
That's my prediction. Yes, I do think that. I don't think Trump's good at governing. I don't think that his administration is going to be successful. I think that the incumbent will get thrown out. I think, speaking of incumbent, it is incumbent upon the Democrats to find a good champion. The Democrats have, whether it's George Clooney or someone else, they need it. Politics is not about forcing things upon other people. Politics is about winning elections so you get more of what you want than if you lose them. And Democrats need somebody to really be electable. And that just, we have to focus on that. And if the Democrats do that, I think they will win decisively.
My guest is William Cooper. His book is called How America Works and Why It Doesn't, A Brief Guide to the U.S. Political System. It's a good one. You should read it. And William Cooper, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. I really enjoy coming on, so appreciate you having me.
I want you to meet my friend, Lissa Warren. She is the founder and president of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. And she's a professor at Emerson College in Boston, and she joins me quite frequently here on From the Bookshelf. Lissa, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Gary.
What have you been reading?
I have been reading a book by Kevin B. Smith, who is a political science professor, the chair of the department, actually, at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. The book is called The Jailer's Reckoning, and the subtitle is How Mass Incarceration is Damaging America. He has a lot of numbers in this book that surprised me, a lot of statistics. It turns out that the U.S. incarcerates more people than any other industrialized democracy in the world. We have more ex-prisoners than the entire population of Ireland, and more people with a felony record than the populations of Denmark, Norway, New Zealand, and Liberia combined. So he questions in this book, why did the United States become the world's biggest jailer? And then, just as importantly, what has it done to us as a country? What are the costs, socially, economically, and politically, of having the world's largest population of ex-prisoners, and what can we do about it? It really is a landmark book. It is the first book to really tackle this topic in such a reasoned, footnoted, researched way. He explains that the U.S. became the world's biggest jailer because politicians wanted to do something about a very real problem with violent crime. That effort was accelerated by a variety of partisan and socio-demographic trends that started to significantly reshape the political environment in the 1980s and the 1990s. The force of those trends varied from state to state, but ultimately they led not just to historically unprecedented levels of incarceration, but equally unprecedented numbers of ex-prisoners. Serving time behind bars is now normalized. It's a normalized social experience. It affects the majority of Americans either directly or indirectly. There's a clear price, which he refers to as the jailer's reckoning, to be paid for all of this. And as he shows, that price is a society with declining levels of civic cohesion and reduced economic prospects and less political engagement. Mass incarceration turns out to be something of a hidden bomb. It's a social explosion that he says inflicts enormous civic collateral damage on the entire country. And he feels it's something we all need to do something about. And I think the part of the book that really hit home with me the most is how much it affects the prisoner's family when, you know, the person goes away to jail for years, decades, the rest of their life sometimes. I mean, it's not just a matter of loneliness and, you know, like who's going to help take care of the kids now? You're a single parent, but the economics of it, the way that it impacts them economically, and the social pariahs that they become just because they have a loved one who is in prison. You think about the prisoner, but boy, the effects on not just the immediate family, but like generations of their family are affected by this. It was a very sobering account, I have to say, but it is a very important, very necessary book.
And so does he interview prisoners? Does he interview families of prisoners and that sort of thing?
He does, and he interviews many prisoners themselves, you know, some of whom are still incarcerated and others who have been out and, you know, are still in the process of trying to get their lives back on track and acclimate to the outside world. He talks about how it really varies from state to state, you know, how long you go away for and even what you go away for at all, and how, you know, like in Maine, you could steal a lobster roll and one thing would happen to you. And then in Texas, you could steal a tuna sandwich and another thing would happen to you. And some of it depends on prior offenses you've had and what the rules are, the laws are pertaining to those. You know, a lot of this is state by state. And when you look at the rates of imprisonment, incarceration in places like Louisiana and Texas, they're so much greater. They're so disproportionate to other states. And it's not because those states all are full of bad people, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's something off. There's something off.
And does he talk about the racial divide in prison?
Oh, absolutely. Oh my gosh, so much so. Yeah. Very much so. I mean, African Americans, it's a disproportionate number of prisoners, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
You know that just from hearing it in the news, you know, and he also just really hammers home the fact that we have incarcerated so many people that in many states, they cannot find enough prison guards to supervise the number of prisoners that they have. And consequently, the prisoners have to stay in their cells for really large amounts of the day or even week because they can't guard them if they're out of the cells. And that takes a giant hit on their physical well-being, their mental health too. It's terrible. It's really a very broken system, a very, very broken system in this country. In some states more than others, more broken than others.
And Kevin B. Smith, what do you know about him?
He is a professor in Nebraska, and he did a previous book called Disposed, and that one was subtitled Liberals, Conservatives, and the Biology of Political Differences. So he studies politics. He teaches politics and policy. He's been teaching for more than 20 years. I don't know if he's been at University of Nebraska-Lincoln that whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that he has risen through the ranks there and now chairs the poli-sci department.
Wow. I wonder what he means.
He was a newspaper reporter for a while, too. So he's got kind of that investigative journalist bent, which comes through in the book.
I wonder what he means by the biology of political differences. I have to read that book, too.
I think that sounds interesting, too. I need to check that out.
Yeah.
I always like that when I like an author's book and then I find out they have other ones and the titles and subtitles intrigue me of those too. So yeah, I've got some checking to do on that one.
Kevin B. Smith, The Jailer's Reckoning, How Mass Incarceration is Damaging America. Well, thank you for bringing us
that
book. You got
it. It came out yesterday. So it's brand spanking new.
Fantastic. Thank you, Lisa, for telling us about it, and we'll talk to you again on From the Bookshelf very soon.
Thanks, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.